This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. In today's program, we delve deeper into the multinational warfare now taking place in the Horn of Africa nation of Somalia. We'll be speaking with longtime Africa human rights specialist Alex DeWall about the details of the Kenyan invasion, the Ethiopian involvement, and the quagmire that is threatened with the current activity. Also, there is clandestine and remote warfare taking place at the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And in recent days, 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed in 2 hours by a sustained United States airborne bomb and missile attack. Pakistan has cut off the supply lines of the U.S. into Afghanistan and has asked the CIA to quit a drone spy base inside Pakistan. We'll be speaking about the consequences of these policies with Fred Bronfman, the man who discovered the U.S. secret bombing of Cambodia. All of that and more, including a look inside the State Department as to how African invasions get started. This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and today we delve even deeper into the crisis in Eastern Africa, particularly in Somalia, where over the past 24 hours, the Shabab movement has ordered more than a dozen relief agencies outside of the country, and there were attacks on some facilities in southern parts of Somalia. Among those who are being asked to leave are UNICEF and the World Health Organization. Somalia is a nation on the Horn of Africa that comprises prime ocean estate in the northeastern corner of that continent, and for many years it has been the a victim of foreign invasions. It has been struggling to establish a unified national government, and most recently it has been invaded by Kenya, as well as reports of Ethiopian troops incursing into Somalia. In addition, the African Continent Intervention Force comprises troops from Uganda and Burundi. And, of course, Somalia has become the most recent one of the more prominent killing fields of United States remote-operated predator drones. And it is on this occasion that we're very pleased to have with us Alex DeWall, a longtime and principled observer of human rights with a great specialty in Africa and indeed Somalia. He is one of two people, along with Rakaya Omar, who resigned or were displaced from Africa Watch, a subset of Human Rights Watch, during the mid-1990s because they opposed the United States invasion of Somalia. And Professor DeWall is now the executive director of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School of Tufts University Graduate School of International Affairs. And I've been waiting a long time to talk to you, sir. Welcome to 5 o'clock shadow.
It's a pleasure.
Well, let's just get right on the ground with what you understand to be the latest dimensions of the crisis in Somalia. Kenya invaded, but now I hear they're suing for peace or begging the United States for military and tactical assistance. Ugandan troops have been sighted going into the country, and it seems as if it's a free-for-all inside Somalia. What is your assessment?
The situation in Somalia is pretty grim, and the external powers who are intervening, including a number of African nations, and behind them the United States, which is also not intervening with its own forces but with drones and missiles, are convinced that there is a security threat in Somalia, and that is correct. There is a militant wing, Al-Shabaab, and there are individuals within Al-Shabaab who are threatening wider interests. But they, in intervening, they seem to be ignoring the lessons from decades of attempts to resolve problems in Somalia, which is that if you go in as an outsider into Somalia and try and shoot your way to a solution, the Somalis shoot back. And external intervention tends to unite at least a substantial section of the Somali population and the armed Somali population at that around more militant positions. It tends to be counterproductive.
The governance of Somalia has gone through different phases, and there was a time, I seem to recall, when the Union of Islamic Courts had a pragmatic governance that was more effective than the most recently internationally imposed transitional governments by Doha versus Mogadishu and foreign interests. Can you help us understand a bit more about the dynamics of the clan structure in Somalia versus the, I guess, Western power template of how a government might operate in a society that is at least partially tribalized?
Well, when the central government collapsed in Somalia in the 1980s, leading to the formal demise of the last recognized government of Siad Barre in January of 1991, but already it had ceded control over most of the country. What emerged in Somalia were very diverse forms of local governance. And in the northern western part of Somalia, the dominant clan there, the Isaka clan, got together with other clans, and most particularly with the livestock merchants and the diaspora, and worked out a locally run system of government, which is in fact remarkably stable and remarkably democratic. They've had a succession of democratic elections. Governments have changed. The opposition has won on two occasions, so there's been an alternation in power. And it's prospering. And it's done so really without international recognition, with very minimal external involvement. In the south of the country, the problems were arguably greater because there was greater diversity of clan structure and a greater breakdown of traditional authority. But successive interventions, both diplomatic and military, seem only to have worsened that, starting with the Operation Restore Hope, launched by the elder George Bush in 1992, subsequent diplomatic efforts to shore up what was always going to be a very shaky and fractious central government. And then about 5 years ago, the U.S. Backed an alliance of warlords, really in an attempt to impose some sort of central authority. And these warlords were so abusive and so unpopular that their opponents, which were the Islamic courts, actually got together, drove them out of Mogadishu, and for the first time, this was about 5 years ago, established some sort of workable government. Now, in the fringe of that workable government, there were extremists, and there were some very politically rash and immature individuals who thought this was the moment to expand the reach of their Islamic agenda. But rather than dealing with the rather more moderate and certainly much more pragmatic core of the Islamic courts, most of whom actually were merchants, who the main interest was in making money, the United States and indeed the Ethiopians, the neighbors, decided to seek a military solution. And they destroyed the Islamic courts, but only succeeded in radicalizing the Islamic movement. And the ferocity of the response and the war that has followed has been a direct consequence of this. And what I very much fear is that the current attempt to impose a military solution on Somalia, rather than allowing a political solution to emerge, will only further radicalize and embitter those elements that are ready to fight at all costs.
With the tribal structure, with the families and the different social groupings in different parts of Somalia, whether it be, I think, in the northwest, in Somaliland and Puntland, and the differences down south, Jubaland and so on, with the nonconformity of the national boundaries and of the governments that attempt to be imposed there, by not taking into account the social structures of that region, are we seeing the aftermath of colonial policy in dividing up Africa?
We're seeing certainly the aftermath of colonial policy because Somalia, which is the Somali Peninsula, which is a remarkably ethnic basically homogeneous region was divided five ways. Two parts went to Britain, one to France, one to Italy, and one to Ethiopia. More particularly, we're seeing the aftermath of or the impact of attempts to impose in the current era a very straightforward Western-based model of a centralized, institutionalized state, and which bears very, very little relation to those parts of Somalia and those things in Somalia that actually work. For example, since the dismantling of the central government, Somalia has one of the world's most efficient telecommunications systems. It has great mobile phones, great internet. It has a fantastic financial system. For Somalis all over the world can send money back home with great speed and great efficiency, far better than the banking systems of all the neighboring countries. And why is it, one asks, that the Somalis are able to run some of the most sophisticated international systems of this nature in where there is really no international interference or regulation, and yet seem unable to put together under international tutelage a central government? Is there not a different model based on the traditional clan system and based upon the remarkable entrepreneurial and dynamic character of the Somali people? Is there not a different model that might actually work better in these circumstances?
The interests of Somalia extend beyond the technical borders of the nation. And there is this so-called Jubaland initiative of the Kenyan government, which was advised by the United States at one point in less than 2 years ago to not proceed about it, and yet it has come to pass. The attempt, I think, to militarily take over southern Somalia as far north as Kismayo, one of the secondary major ports. And they're being buttressed by Ethiopian troops, whom are rude by the Somalian people because of the excesses of the 2006 to 2008 invasion. What is your understanding about this precipitous activity of Kenya? They say that it's to stabilize their northern mixed populations and such, but how do you assess the Kenyan intervention?
Well, there's no doubt that both Kenya and also Ethiopia have genuine security fears about Somalia. There have been criminal attacks, abductions in Kenya. In the case of Ethiopia, there were terrorist attacks in parts of Ethiopia, including the Ethiopian capital and the government of Eritrea, which is in a state of cold war with Ethiopia, was responsible for arming some of the militant elements in Somalia. So there is no doubt that there is a genuine security risk, and there's a wider security risk, which we've seen in the phenomenon of piracy off the Somali coast. But that having been said, the fact that consistently over the years, the primary response to these security problems has been a military response, and those military responses have not worked, should give pause for thought. Should it not be the case that the engagement with Somalia should not follow, should cease to follow this dual track of primarily treating it as an international policing stroke security problem, and secondarily trying to impose a very simplified template of a national state on this country? Should there not be a different kind of political process that would allow much more diverse forms of governance to emerge in Somalia, including those that have demonstrably worked in the northwestern, northeastern parts of the country?
We're speaking with Professor Alex DeWall of the World Peace Foundation of the Fletcher School of Tufts University. And Professor DeWall, there seems to have been a major tactical change in the nature of United States intervention in Somalia. You were with Africa Watch during the early to mid-1990s, when you and your colleague Rekaya Omar were kicked out of Human Rights Watch because you did not go along with what Human Rights advocated as being the U.S. invasion of Somalia. During that time, and I'd like for you to reflect upon that time in order to understand today, during that time, major point of contention for some Americans is the so-called Black Hawk Down incident, in which perhaps 1,000 Somalis died and a dozen and a half or so American troops. Now we see, under the Obama administration, the exponential expansion of remote control predator drones flown out of Pakistan, flown out of Texas, North and South Carolina, and everywhere else around the world but the place of detonation. Is this a perfect storm that emboldens the United States to intervene more viciously or more militarily because for domestic consumption, the idea of not putting U.S. troops at risks is a factor. So can you reflect on the difference between 1992-93 and the way war is waged today?
Well, it was very striking back in 1993 how the U.S. In fighting General Idd during the summer of 1993, leading to that infamous Black Hawk Down incident, was following a policy of as few U.S. casualties as possible, in fact, preferably zero U.S. casualties. I was in Mogadishu at the time, and the way that this conflict was fought involved really a considerable number of unacknowledged Somali fatalities. And in fact, the U.S. were by no means the worst offenders in this regard. The Belgians, the Nigerians, the Italians were also engaged, and there were really considerable numbers of incidents that, in my view, warranted at least investigation as potential violations of international humanitarian law. And when I went to the military attorney of the UN force there, who was actually an American, and I said, in my view, their violations of the Geneva Conventions are occurring, I got the most remarkable response, which was, we're not bound by the Geneva Conventions, we're the UN. And it seemed to be quite astonishing that the UN forces would consider themselves above international humanitarian law in that regard, because they had a UN Security Council mandate. In fact, I think the military attorney, when I was quite taken aback when I expressed shock and began to backtrack. But nonetheless, at that time, you could see very clearly that the dynamic at work was to minimize, if not eliminate, U.S. casualties, in fact, all international casualties, even if that meant undertaking military actions that put considerable numbers of Somalis at risk. Now, the current development of using unmanned drones is an accentuation of that. And, of course, the targeting technology is now such that the risks of civilian casualties are ostensibly reduced. But nonetheless, in the predator attacks that occurred during the offensives against al-Shabaab a few years ago, there were considerable numbers of civilians killed. And the Somali response to this was one of outrage, but also one of saying, what cowardly force is this that shoots us from a distance and doesn't dare and come and confront us? And the Somalis are nothing if not courageous. And I think the implications, the political implications of this remote delivery of death with zero risk to those who are actually involved in implementing, carrying out these missions, does send very important messages to the countries, to the nations on the receiving end. And the implications of those, I think, have yet to be internalized. They're very, very clearly seen as setting a double standard, that some lives are more valuable than others. And I think this is very unfortunate.
Alex DeWall is the executive director of the Fletcher School at Tufts University's World Peace Foundation. And in order for ourselves and our audience to stay better informed than the propaganda and the sometimes conflicted interests of intervening institutions. How can people stay well educated about the nuances of Somalia and not be confused by institutions who confuse humanitarian interests with establishmentarian interests and thereby may risk entanglement in U.S. foreign policy?
It's remarkably difficult, actually, to really to get an idea of what's going on, because the information on the other side is on the side of al-Shabaab is outrageous and often highly inaccurate. But there are fortunately a number of websites and so on run by humanitarian agencies and by the UN, which can be consulted. There's the IRIN, the International, the Integrated Regional Information Network of the UN, for example, that provides some really pretty objective information.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. It really has been a useful revelation speaking with you, Alex DeWall, of the World Peace Foundation that you direct. And we shall stay in touch. I leave the last word to you.
Well, it's a pleasure to be on the program, and I really hope that it's possible for Africa and the wider international community to learn the lessons of Somalia and not to keep on repeating these failed and counterproductive attempts to impose a solution which, frankly, ain't ever going to work.
Alex DeWall of the World Peace Foundation at the Fletcher School of Tufts University. Thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow, and later in the program, we'll be speaking with Fred Bronfman, the man who discovered the U.S. secret bombing in Cambodia, about secret bombing in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere. But we continue the Somali theme for the nonce with a look at how the Kenyan invasion of Somalia got started. There was a very precipitous meeting at the Kenyan embassy between the United States and the Kenyan government, which was militating to have its war in southern Somalia. This is the basis of a meeting of January 30th, 2010, as detailed in a State Department confidential memorandum or cable that is dated February 2nd, 2010, courtesy of WikiLeaks.
Confidential. Subject. Assistant Secretary Carson's January 30th, 2010. Meeting with Kenyan Foreign Minister Wetangula. Origin, Embassy Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Tuesday, 2nd February 2010. Paragraph 1. Summary, a high-level Kenyan delegation headed by Foreign Minister Wetangula used a long January 30th meeting on the margins of the AU summit to lobby Assistant Secretary for African Affairs Johnny Carson's support for the government of Kenya's long-incubating Lower Juba initiative. Wetangula, the Minister of Defense, the Director of the National Security and Intelligence Services, and the military's Chief of Staff, each in turn highlighted the dangers to Kenya emanating from Somalia and advertised an incursion into Somalia by the roughly 2,000 Somali forces currently being trained by the government of Kenya as the best solution. The Kenyan delegation assured Assistant Secretary Carson that both Somalia's transitional federal government and the government of Ethiopia supported Kenya's efforts and insisted that Assistant Secretary Carson's long-standing concerns about the Kenyan plan had all been addressed. Paragraph 2. Assistant Secretary Carson tactfully, but categorically refused the Kenyan delegation's attempts to enlist USG support for their effort. He worried that the Lower Juba Initiative could be very expensive, that it could catalyze clan and sub-clan rivalries, that success could create a rival to the transitional federal government, that the government of Kenya could be unwittingly providing training to future or current ONLF members, and that the government of Kenya was not prepared to handle the domestic repercussions should their effort fail. The January 30th meeting marked Wetangula's third attempt to enlist Assistant Secretary Carson's support and was only the latest in a long-running campaign by the Kenyan government to an USG agreement to its Initiative. The persistence with which the government of Kenya is courting the USG suggests, if nothing else, that they have finally awakened to the implications for Kenya of long-term instability in Somalia and are attempting belatedly to address the problem. End comment and summary. Wetangula previews government of Kenya's domestic achievements before discussing the Lower Juba Initiative. Domestic progress threatened by continuing problems in Somalia. Paragraph 5. Wetangula contrasted the progress being made on the domestic agenda with the threat posed to Kenya by continuing instability in Somalia. He alleged that 6,000 refugees enter Kenya from Somalia each month, pointed to the overextended data of refugee camps in northeast Kenya, that the government of Kenya had intercepted 10 attempts to smuggle in bomb-making materials in the past year, recalled the domestic unrest triggered by the recent visit of a controversial Jamaican Muslim cleric to Kenya, and forecast repercussions from Kenya's good faith efforts to meet its obligations under the Memorandum of Understanding on Piracy is extremely worrisome. Transitional Federal Government, Government of Ethiopia, Support Kenyan Initiative. Paragraph 6. Wetangula alleged that the Somalia Transitional Federal Government had proposed the Jubilant Initiative to Kenya and that the government of Ethiopia, after some initial questions, had endorsed it as well. The Kenyan effort was being coordinated by a team based in Prime Minister Odinga's office, Wetangula said, but the Prime Minister and President Kibaki co-chair the effort in order to make it truly bipartisan. The team had recently met with Prime Minister Meles for over 2 hours, Wetangula said, and had successfully addressed all of the government of Ethiopia Prime Minister's concerns. Paragraph 7. While he acknowledged that the transitional federal government had limited capacity, Wetangula argued that strategic concerns meant that Kenya had to support it. Assistant Secretary Carson's questions about Kenyan plan. Paragraph 8. Assistant Secretary Carson reviewed the history of excellent U.S.-Kenya cooperation and praised the government of Kenya's efforts to discharge its international obligations. The USG shared the government of Kenya's concerns about Somalia and strongly supported the transitional federal government and the Djibouti peace process. The U.S. was the largest contributor to UNISOM and was attempting to induce TCCs to contribute troops to the AU's effort. Paragraph 9. Noting that he had carefully weighed the pros and cons of the Kenyan proposal, Assistant Secretary Carson worried that the initiative could backfire, warning that we did not want to create situations we cannot control, then highlighted his concerns. The undertaking could be more complicated and much more expensive than the Kenyans forecast. An incursion could trigger clan and sub-clan rivalries that could worsen matters in Lower Juba. If successful, a Lower Juba entity could emerge as a rival to the transitional federal government. It was possible that the government of Kenya could be unwittingly providing training to present or future members of the ONLF. Did the government of Kenya have a plan should their troops be defeated? Was the government of Kenya willing to persevere if there was a negative outcome?
And that, some of the concerns raised in a January 30th, 2010 meeting in which the precursors of the Somalian invasion that we see today, plus the Ethiopian participation, were becoming well manifest. And now today Kenya is asking the United States for more military support for its Jubaland initiative. The U.S., of course, is firing Predator drones throughout the nation of Somalia. And that's not the only place where remote control warfare is taking place. There was recently a major incident in which at least 24 Pakistani soldiers were killed in a U.S. Bombardment that lasted 2 hours, according to Pakistani officials, near the Afghan border. It is unclear at this point in time whether this was a trap, a revenge, or confusion, or incompetence in the conduct of the cross-border warfare in the United States' seemingly endless war on terror. To help us understand that, we're Happy to be joined at this moment by Fred Bronfman. He is a familiar to 5 o'clock shadow. He is the man who first discovered or reported upon the United States secret bombardment of Cambodia. And here we are, Fred, once again with the same initiatives, but with new technology. What is your current understanding of the situation in Pakistan and near the Afghan border and the operations there, including the slaughter of the Pakistani troops by U.S.?
Well, I think the key point is not only the bombardment of the 24 soldiers, but it was apparently one of these CAA paramilitary teams that we've organized sending Afghans into Pakistan. I mean, this has been known before. This time they just happened to get caught. So I think it's another example of us stirring the pot in Pakistan in a way that's very harmful to our own national security interests.
Fred, you have recently written about this issue in Ceylon, and among the warnings that you bring us is, and here I'm quoting you, short-sighted U.S. policy is creating a national security disaster in Pakistan. That policy is trying to win in tiny Afghanistan by extending the war-making into giant nuclear-armed Pakistan, including drone strikes, cross-border raids, illegal U.S. ground assassination, and forcing the Pakistani army to wage scorched-earth offensives. It threatens the greatest U.S. foreign policy disaster since its support for the Shah of Iran. Tell us more about what concerns you about these events today, Fred Bronfman.
Well, it's part of an overall strategic era of historic proportions, which is they were fighting their war in Afghanistan. Now, if it was up to me, we would have pulled out of Afghanistan the day before yesterday. But even if you want to fight in Afghanistan, what they did is they decided to take the war into Pakistan in order to win in Afghanistan. So in order to win a war in a pretty relatively unimportant country, Afghanistan, with only 30 million people, they destabilized the giant nuclear-armed nation of Pakistan with 180 million people and made the whole country hate us.
Mm.
You know, there was a Pew poll that said that 69% of the people of Pakistan regard us as their enemy. That's 125 million Muslims in Pakistan regard us as their enemy. Mm. It just makes no sense.
What is some of the blowback that concerns you about this policy?
Well, the most important is the nuclear issue. Pakistan has the world's fastest-growing nuclear stockpile, and by everybody's account, the least secure. When the first set of WikiLeaks cables came out, we found out that our ambassador, Ann Patterson, her main concern was that nuclear materials could leak out of the plants and fall into terrorist hands. So you've got a situation where, on the one hand, we're infuriating 125 million people. Well, some of those are people working in the nuclear plants. And this is not something, you know, that is being made up by a journalist. This is straight from our ambassador's mouth. So that's the first concern. Secondly, our actions in Pakistan, I should say, our leaders' actions in Pakistan have so angered the Pakistani military that there's now talk of a coup has been on the front page of the New York Times, a military coup by younger officers. This, of course, would be a disaster of unprecedented dimensions. I mean, look at how we're going crazy now, because Iran may have a nuclear bomb, and Pakistan already has one. Thirdly, we're helping the terrorist forces within Pakistan are growing enormously as a result of our drone strikes. We're threatening the Pakistani government from that direction. I mean, you put all of it together, and it really is very counterproductive what our leaders are doing. They're making it more likely there'll be another 911. I mean, think about it. If there's one country on Earth that the next 911 would come from, I think everyone would say it's most likely to come from Pakistan.
There has been, not only in the Afghanistan-Pakistan region, but seemingly like blossoms in the spring throughout the whole world, a new paradigm of U.S. military tactics of warfare relying heavily on command and control from the other side of the world with the Predator drones. It's sort of like the incarnation of the film reference to Skynet from Terminator.
Yeah, well, when I discovered the U.S. secret air war in Laos 40 years ago, it was the world's first automated war, war by machine, in which there were no U.S. ground troops involved. But our leaders leveled the entire country, dropped 2 million tons of bombs on them, as much as we dropped on all of Europe and the Pacific here in World War II. So I've been predicting the advent of automated war for some time now, and now I'm afraid it's coming true.
Elaborate on that, about the prediction of automated warfare and its consequences when the current administration and others before them are relying more on LINT and SIGINT than they are on HUMINT, and whether or not a flying drone with heavy missiles can overcome human organization among tribes and those who resent the presence of those of death from above.
Well, they've admitted to 2,500, let's just take this first, 2,500 drone murders in Pakistan. They've murdered 2,500 human beings in Pakistan to date, of whom they can only name 56 as important al-Qaeda leaders or Taliban leaders. Let's call it 100 they can name. 90% of the people they're killing, they can't even name. They're killing unarmed suspects who are being accused by us of being combatants at war with us, and then they're executing them. No trial, no evidence, no chance to prove their innocence. And they've made hundreds and hundreds of mistakes, documented civilian deaths to date. This is really a moral disaster. But what I'm equally concerned about, let's think of it from a strategic point of view. They've killed 2,500 people in Pashtun areas. Well, there's 27 million Pashtuns on the Pakistani side of the border. That's as many as almost the total number of Vietnamese in North and South Vietnam during the war, and we couldn't even defeat, with 550,000 troops, we couldn't defeat 30 million Vietnamese. They are now provoking 180 million Pakistanis, including 27 million Pashtuns, to hate us, making nuclear cooperation impossible, according to Ann Patterson. But they're doing that. They've killed, let's say, 2,500 people, but for everyone they kill, they create 10, 20, 50 new enemies. We have countless. I mean, you know, if there were under 1,000 people in 911 as a member of al-Qaeda, very generously speaking, our leaders have now created tens of thousands of people, potential suicide bombers, not only within Pakistan, but in London. You know, there are a million Pakistanis in London. David Cameron was quoted in the WikiLeaks cables as saying that they'd been radicalized by the invasion of Iraq. And these are people with British passports. This is a very serious... I've never been this alarmed in my lifetime as to what our leaders are now doing in Pakistan, and they're killing these 24 Pakistanis is just a symbol of what they've been up to.
With a presidential campaign coming up and Barack Obama bragging about killing Osama bin Laden and the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, and the belligerent talking points that will almost certainly be used in the coming campaign, what kind of redress is there to a bipartisan politics of aggression without understanding, a bipartisan support for the war, a reluctance to roll back and withdraw, to stop the policy of killing people till they stop hating us? What international or juridical remedies exist for this new paradigm of undeclared and, by international standards, humanitarian standards, illegal warfare?
Unfortunately, there's none. The only hope is that within the United States, people will wake up. I've given up hoping people will make up to the moral issues involved, but they might wake up to the fact that we've wasted $3 trillion on these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we're worse off than when we got started. Meanwhile, during that same period, our Japanese competitors have invested $3 trillion in monopolizing or getting control of the renewable energy industries of the future. Our leaders are impoverishing us as well as committing these crimes. Well, the hope is that people will wake up and realize that. I look at something like Occupy Movement. I've got great hopes for it. I don't know what's going to happen. But, if there's a power shift in this country, is the only way to stop these misguided policies.
Do you think that these undeclared wars of trivial results and troublesome consequences are in any way related with their multi-trillion dollar budgets to the domestic economic crisis?
I think the fact that they wasted $3 trillion of money that was desperately needed back here at home, I mean, a fraction of that would bring the unemployment rate in half. They've wasted our treasure. They've made us, less secure. And by the way, if there is another 9-1-1 in this country, it will probably mean the end of our democracy as we know it. I mean, they already are, have been moving towards more and more paramilitary police activities, the local police forces around the country. If there's another 9-1-1, I'm very worried that democracy as we know it will end it. And the ironic thing, it's just our own leaders who are making that horrible prospect more likely, and who will then gain from it if it happens, because then they'll ask for more money, for more weapons, for more prisons, for more jails.
Well, Fred Bronfman, I'm very happy to have you here to share the analysis and sound the alarm about
I just think
policies.
The only hope is for people to wake up and realize that your own freedom, your own ability to live is at stake over the next decade. The people running our country right now, you could see that on Wall Street, where they almost destroyed the economy. They have no idea what they're doing. I mean, this business of provoking 180 million Pakistanis to hate us in return for killing a couple of thousand so-called Al-Qaeda, who they can't even name, is a strategic error of monumental proportions.
And, Fred, you have written recently in Salon one of your pieces, The Petraeus Projection, the DCI, the Director of Central Intelligence, record since the surge. Where else can people keep up to date with your scrutiny of clandestine warfare?
Well, I usually write on Salon, Truth Digger, Alternate. Yeah. I was mentioning about General Petraeus. The point of that article was that however you feel it did about the surge in Iraq, his 10 years since, as the head of CENTCOM, where he was responsible for Pakistan policy, and then his tenure in Afghanistan, were absolute disasters. And one of the worst thing that happens to a nation is they venerate a general who has early successes, like Napoleon, and then they hand over the keys to the kingdom to him, and he turns out to be a disaster. Napoleon, almost destroyed France. Henry Navarre was a hero until Dien Bien Phu.
Well, to
And this is what we're talking about with David Petraeus. He's been a monumental disaster. He's been a violent, blood-filled reign of terror when he was in charge of troops in Afghanistan. He's now been given a license. He wakes up every day. He's overseeing a force of 60,000 special operations troops that are operating in 75 countries, killing anyone they feel like without anyone even knowing about it.
Well, thank you, Fred Bronfman. To paraphrase the old saying, everything bold is new again. Thank you, Fred. We're going to have to leave it there.
Yeah, I hope I cheered you up.
Oh, yes. You know, the optimist says, this is the best of all worlds. And the pessimist says, this is the best of all worlds. Thank you, Fred Bronfman. This is 5 o'clock shadow. And thanks to Professor Alex DeWall. Thank you to WikiLeaks. Thank you, Thiago Brozo, for production today, and Michael G. Haskins for excellent engineering. We seek your tips, leaks, questions, and suggestions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 o'clock shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.
And home-use technologies are just a few of the many applications that Skynet Research is undertaking in our search for the next big thing. Skynet Research has got its eyes on the future. Here at Skynet Research, we're working nonstop to create the next level of robotics. Skynet Research, a global leader in artificial intelligence technologies.
Say hello to the soldier of tomorrow, the T-1 Battlefield Robot, a fully autonomous ground defensive system. And in the air, the Hunter-Killer aerial weapons platform. This isn't science fiction, it's reality, thanks to our top-secret innovation, Skynet, the revolutionary artificially intelligent battlefield management network. Using designs generated by Skynet, we need no longer risk the well-being of our men and women in uniform. Robots will take their place on the front lines.
Hi! I'm Chief Master Sergeant William Candy. I was honored to be selected by CRS in the ongoing effort to save American lives.
Great leaders are in war. And you are tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org on the web. Thank you so much for tuning in. 5 o'clock shadow with Robert Knight. We'll be back tomorrow at 5 p.m.